Port of Kingston versus Brewster.
Good morning. Carl Marquardt, counsel for the appellants, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. So the appellants in this case maintain, and there was evidence in the record to show that Kingston Adventures was evicted from their tenancy at the Port of Kingston because the owners were publicly critical of the port and port officials. More pointedly, that they were evicted in part because they would not agree to enter a non-disparagement provision that would have prevented them from criticizing port officials. And we don't think that's okay, although I will acknowledge that the question of whether that actually constitutes a defense to an eviction under Washington law is debatable. And then the appellants and all of them were subject to a judgment for prevailing party attorney's fees without, I will argue, any sound legal basis. So I want to talk about the attorney fee issue first, because that becomes sort of the tail that wags the dog here for this little tenant, and then I'll talk about the right to possession. So the claim for attorney's fees in this case presents a straightforward question of contract interpretation. The provision that the port relies upon is part of a preprinted standard form agreement that was prepared by the port. There's no question, it was drafted by the port, and no context evidence was offered. So the interpretation is a question of law that is squarely before the court. The contract provides for the recovery of attorney fees, quote, in any action or proceeding for the collection of any sums which may be payable hereunder. So the question is, what does that mean? I think it's pretty straightforward. The use of the preposition for in the English language indicates that something is done with the object or purpose of achieving something. So an action or proceeding, when the contract speaks of an action or proceeding for the collection of sums due under the lease, I think the common sense understanding of that language is that if I, landlord, have to sue you to recover sums payable, i.e. rent, then I get to recover my attorney's fees. And this is a limited provision for attorney's fees, which is limited for a reason. Actions to collect rent are usually actions brought by landlords, and they want to make the right to recover fees as one-sided as possible.
Did the landlord here recover a judgment of $415.36 for rent?
They did, Your Honor.
So then, doesn't that trigger the attorney fee provision?
No. they did, but that wasn't why the action was brought, because the tenant didn't owe any rent when the action was brought. What happened, of course, was that the landlord brought the action and then refused the tender of rent and then sought a judgment for the rent that hadn't been paid while the action was pending at the end. But that doesn't make this an action for the collection of rent. I think it would be more accurate to call this an action for not collecting rent, right? The non-collection of rent was the result of the action, not the cause of it. And so I think that a straightforward, common-sense interpretation of that language is that the attorney fee provision applies in a case where the either party, presumably the tenant, owes money and the landlord is then forced to sue. And that's not what this case was. This was an action to terminate the tenancy based on the stated grounds that the lease had expired. The port could have drafted an attorney fee provision to cover this scenario, but it didn't. So, as I say, I think the plain language here does not give the port a right to fees. To the extent that there's ambiguity on that, of course, the agreement should be interpreted our way. And so I think my client ought to prevail on that issue. There's a related issue of personal liability for fees that was imposed on the Brewsters individually, which the court doesn't have to reach if you agree with our argument on the contract language, but I think that that was also an error by the trial court. And I should say I have some sympathy for the trial court. The Tenants' Council was raising a lot of arguments here, and it was hard to sort out what was going on. But the port was also playing fast and loose with the agreements. And in any case, the task here is to get it right. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on that issue. But
well, if you are correct on either one of those issues, what is it that you're saying that the result should be? What should happen?
Right. So the if I'm right on the contract language on. As to the right to fees, then the court would reverse the judgment for fees.
I thought there was some argument that tied that to the whole action. I mean, in other words, there was a motion to vacate the judgment as a whole for an irregularity. And so the court, as I understand it, said, well, there wasn't really any. There was an irregularity. I'll say that because I'm going to take it. I'm going to agree with counsel that. Or I'm going to accept counsel representation that counsel did not get notice. But it doesn't matter because there it wouldn't have made any difference. There's really no dispute here. So are you saying that the whole judgment should be overturned and everything started over?
I think there's two separate issues. I think the first issue you're referring to and all the, you know, the motion to abate and the motion to vacate and all of that related to possession of the premises.
Yeah.
But at the end, the port came back and filed a motion for attorney's fees, and there's a money judgment.
So from your standpoint, all you're really asking for is to, I mean, at least as far as you've talked about so far, you're talking what the remedy would be to reverse the judgment for attorney's fees.
Correct. Right. Or, yes, and then I don't have much time, so I don't want to talk about the personal liability issue, but on that, if there was a question on that, I think the answer would be to remand for a determination on the facts as to who the contracting party actually was, what the port did, or what the court
so
did.
So do you think there are issues of fact as to who the contracting party was? Or
I
the record's not clear?
Worst case for us, there are issues of fact. I mean, I think the you know, you have a written agreement which very clearly states that it you know, it is the operative agreement and that Kingston Adventures LLC was the tenant. And the whole course of dealing, I think, supports that. So it's either a matter of law or, worst case, it would have been issue of fact. But it wasn't a situation where the court could just impose joint and several liability without any analysis or findings. So that's that issue. And in the limited time I have left, as to the issue of possession and the retaliatory eviction, the Port of Longview case is actually very close to this case, also a case where the tenant was under a month-to-month lease and was evicted for complaining about the port. The court held that the tenant was entitled to an affirmative defense to eviction based on retaliatory eviction. The port tried to distinguish the Longview case based on the third of the three requirements that the Longview court set out. And there are the port here's argument is that Kingston Adventures was in breach of their lease because they were in a holdover period, and therefore they're not entitled to rely on Longview. I think that is not a compelling argument. I think they were holdover tenants operating under a month-to-month lease as a matter of law. So I don't think this situation is actually any different on that point than Longview, which also involved a month-to-month tenancy. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Howard Goodfriend representing the respondent, Port of Kingston. Let me address the issue of possession first. The port terminated the Brewsters' month-to-month lease for these kayak berths because the lease prohibited commercial use without the express permission. The parties had a business use agreement. It expired after a year, and the port was under no obligation to continue allowing a commercial enterprise to operate without any agreement whatsoever that addressed the very critical aspects of the port's liability to the public in the event something happened. And the parties, it is conceded, and the trial court found based on undisputed facts on this motion to vacate, that there were bona fide areas of disagreement having nothing to do with disparagement, setting aside the issue of whether a mutual disparagement clause in the proprietary capacity of the port like this implicates the First Amendment. Of course, I don't really have to reach that because there were limitation of the liability issues, there were limitation of use issues, those were conceded, they weren't able to reach an agreement, and that was the basis for the termination.
Well, Appellant's counsel just got through saying that that doesn't, that you haven't really distinguished the Port of Longview case because that was a month-to-month tenancy also.
Well, the distinction in Port of Longview expressly says that it's not retaliatory eviction. No presumption of retaliation arises where even if there are criticisms and public statements of a public entity as a landlord, there is nonetheless an undisputed breach of the lease. This lease required a business use agreement. There was none.
And you're saying that was not the case in the Longview case?
In Longview, what happened, there was a month-to-month lease. The tenant was making public statements that were well-documented about environmental hazards at the port, something completely unrelated to their tenancy. That was documented. It was in the record. It was in public meetings. And right after those statements were made, the month-to-month lease terminated. There were no other issues about a breach of the lease whatsoever. They were perfectly in compliance. It was a month-to-month tenancy, and the court said under these circumstances, there is a presumption of retaliatory eviction, and there should be a trial about whether that was or was not the reason. Here, it was undisputed that there was non-compliance with the lease. That is the distinguishing factor between this case and the Port of Longview case. Let me also address the issues of the attorney's fee clause. I do concede that when this action started, it was not an action for collection of any sums which may be payable hereunder within the meaning of the fee clause of the lease. The lease says there are eight of them. But the arguments below and the argument here really has focused much more on who are the responsible parties for collection of the sums under the lease, whether it's the business, whether it's the Brewsters, and half the briefing below, if not more of it, related to this. And as Judge Becker, you pointed out, there was a judgment entered for non-payment of rent.
An amendment to the complaint that sought a money judgment? It happened during the course of the proceedings.
I don't have the complaint in front of me, but I would be surprised if the complaint did not have a prayer for relief that was sufficiently broad to include sums due under the lease. But I don't have it right in front of me, Your Honor. I can't swear to that. So, you know, the argument also is whether the other point I would raise, and it's not in the brief, but I think it's significant, is that over half of the fees that were incurred, there was a judgment entered when prior counsel did not show up for a show cause hearing. It was for about $7,000 in attorney's fees. There was a motion to vacate under CR 60. The trial court did not find irregularity, Judge Becker. She found excusable neglect, that there was notice, but for some reason there were two notices that counsel did not, claimed he didn't get, and she found that was excusable. So she would entertain the motion and determine whether there was a bona fide defense.
She would entertain what motion?
She would entertain the CR 60. She would hear the CR 60 motion based upon the excusable neglect and determine the second aspect of it, I guess, is what she would entertain, is whether there was a bona fide defense to liability at this stage of the proceedings. She found there was none.
I'm confused. Excusable neglect, doesn't that usually come up in the context of a motion for motion to vacate an order of default?
Well, this was essentially akin to an order of default because there was a hearing scheduled with notice and no one showed up. It would be akin to not showing up at trial. I think it would be a default. But it was CR 60B1 talks about excusable neglect, inadvertence, things like that. So she found grounds under B1, but she... Grounds to determine whether there... Yeah, she in fact vacated the initial judgment and entered an amended judgment that imposed basically the exact same relief, directed a writ of restitution, 2 months back rent, and added another $6,000 in attorney's fees that were spent litigating the issue on the contested hearing on the motion to vacate.
So retained the judgment for $7,000 in attorney's fees and added some more?
She entered a new judgment for $13,000.
Oh, I see. And then was there an additional judgment after that for even more attorney's fees?
No. Okay. No, that was it.
So here we have an argument to sort of go in reverse order based on the appellant's argument, is that the big picture is the whole thing was fouled up because it's like the Port of Longview and the port shouldn't have gotten any relief at all. B, even if the port should have gotten some relief, they shouldn't have gotten attorney's fees because the contract didn't allow it. C, even if the port should have gotten attorney's fees, it shouldn't have gotten attorney's fees against the Brewsters. And D, whatever judgment for attorney's fees the port maybe should or should not have gotten, it shouldn't have been entered unless there were some specific findings entered in conjunction with the court's case law and attorney fees awards. So you're kind of saying, don't talk about issue one. Don't even think about issue two. You might think about issue three, and as about issue four, you haven't opined yet.
Well, I didn't ask you not to think about issue one. I asked you to rule that the trial court correctly decided issue one because there was an admitted breach of the lease and noncompliance with the lease.
All right.
That's issue one.
Okay.
Issue two is the litigation may not have started over issue one, but it certainly morphed based upon the defenses into an action for collection of rent and for who was liable for rent. So that's issue two. Issue three, whether or not the Brewsters are liable or the business is liable, the court imposed joint and several liability because both the business use agreement and the leases had the exact same fee language. One was signed by Mrs. Brewster in her capacity as manager of the marital community, and the other was signed by the business.
But that makes a difference to the appellants, right? Because, I mean, if it's joint and several and if the LLC doesn't have any money, then the Brewsters are going to be personally liable, and their argument is that the Brewsters can't be personally liable.
That's correct. It does make a difference to
them.
So
what do you think about that?
Well, I think they are personally liable because they are – Mrs. Brewster signed the lease without any reference. And some of these birth leases were signed after the business use agreement. I mean, the business use agreement talks about leases.
So you think the record is clear that Mrs. Brewster was signing in a way that requires the court to – or allows the court to impose personal liability?
Yes, she signed them individually with no reference whatsoever to any business under these leases. And, in fact, it's admitted that she first rented the first berth in her individual capacity before the business started, and then she formed the business and got additional berths. But they maintained the character of signing individually. So, I think –
Was this disputed below?
It was raised below. I think it was one of the many issues that were raised below. Yeah, I don't think it was particularly addressed in the trial court's memorandum decision because she was faced with all these other defenses, priority of action, due process, right to jury.
Give us 20 seconds on findings of fact for attorney's fees.
I concede there are none. I mean, I can see that there are no findings of fact. But I would also submit that in the event of a remand on the fee issue, the court should give the trial court authority to impose fees not only under the leases, but also under the terms of CR 60 as a term and condition for vacating the judgment, which she did based upon counsel's failure to appear at the first hearing. Half the fees were incurred because they had to do this do-over, which was totally unnecessary. So I'd ask the court to give the court that authority in the event of any remand on the fee issue. Thank you.
Okay. So below, did the court impose fees based solely on the lease, and is CR 60 a new basis for the court to impose fees on remand?
My understanding is that the court did impose fees based on the lease. I'm sorry, I don't understand what you mean.
And the lease only, not CR 60.
Right.
We just heard that on remand we should direct the court not only to impose fees based on the lease, but also under CR 60. Is CR 60 a new ground?
I believe so. Yeah, I don't believe that argument was raised before. And I think Judge Becker restated the structure of my argument better than I have probably, so I probably should stop there. Regarding the fees, I think counsel conceded that the contract doesn't provide for fees. And granted, there were a lot of other arguments that were raised in the trial court below after the complaint was brought, but that doesn't generate our right to fees under.
Well, what he said was that it morphed into an action for fees.
I don't understand that. They brought an action.
It must have been a request for fees because the judge granted it, right? So at some point it happened.
There was a request for fees based on the contract, granted. I think the question we were getting at was whether it was an action for collection of sums due under the lease.
Right.
And to your question, Judge Spearman, the initial complaint did, as part of its prayer for relief, ask for, rent due or something, but there wasn't any allegation that any rent was owed. So, yes, it was part of the prayer for relief, but I don't think it's fair to say, under the circumstances, it was quite obvious and clear from the complaint that what they were doing was suing to evict someone based on the idea that the lease had expired and not an action for collection of rent. And we absolutely dispute the idea that Beth Brewster signed the contracts in her individual capacity, and it would have been contrary to the business use agreement, which was quite clear as to who the contracting parties were. It wouldn't have made any sense in context, given that Kingston Adventures was quite obviously the tenant. Thank you.
Thank you.